Okay, good morning, everybody. It's good to see a bigger crowd here. Baruch Hashem, Ken Yirbu. We are making more sheets as we speak. They're just copying some more off. I remember I once gave a shiur to a big room where there was only one person in the shiur. And they recorded the shiur and put it online. And then I got a comment afterwards and said, why did you only take questions from the same person through the whole shiur? So now, even if there's only one person in the shiur, I say things like, the lady right at the very back there, I can't hear you. So to say they're making more sheets, but Baruch Hashem, there is a nice crowd here. It's good to see you. I apologize in advance that I'm not going to be here for the next, 3 weeks. I'm going to be on a tour. It sounds very exciting, but believe me, it's not, of the United States and England going recruiting. I am speaking a little bit. I'm speaking for Pesach next Shabbos, Be'ezras Hashem, and also then in Cleveland the Shabbos after. But the way it works is basically every day I go to 3 high schools and present for my seminary, and then I get on the plane and I do the same thing again the next day and the same thing again the next day. So I reckoned up I'm going to be giving the same speech 42 times. Hopefully I will have some brain left at the end. But it'll be a pleasure to get back to you to teaching some Torah as well. There's Torah in America as well, but there's more Torah in Eretz Israel. Last week, let me just say the sponsorship, excuse me, before we get into last week. The Shirim for the whole year have been sponsored by Le'ilui Nishmois, Brana Baspendit, and Zelig Ben Kalman. We're very grateful to the donor for that sponsorship. Now, last week we had an interesting and maybe a tiny little bit controversial Shir. Today's Shir will be also interesting, maybe even more interesting, but not at all controversial, I don't think. What did we talk about last week? We looked at the issue of the apparent conflict between the age of the universe, science, Chumash, Bereishis, the Big Bang, etc. How can we square that? And last week we looked at what is probably the most important answer, which is, why are you reading Parshat Bereishit, and maybe even Parshat Noach, in a literal way? Maybe they're not meant to be read in a literal way. Maybe this is not a story of how the world was made, but why the world was made. And there were many sources. Rashi, we brought the first few Rashis, we brought a Ramban, where they're constantly stressing that Ma'aseh Bereishit, which is discussed by Chazal as one of the deepest Kabbalistic secrets of the universe, is not what it just says on the page. It's much more complicated, subtle, nuanced than that. So maybe the answer is we're not meant to be taking it entirely literally as just a creation of 6 days, etc. Maybe it's not a story of creation at all. It's a story of something far deeper and spiritual, i.e. not physical creation. Or maybe it's both, maybe it's a symbol. That there are all sorts of ways to look at it. We looked at Gan Eden, etc. And we saw that Rav Saadia Gaon said that there is a presumption of literalism. We presume when we look in a pasuk that it is what it says. And if it says there was a tree, there was a tree. Unless he says there are 4 reasons why we don't take psukim literally. And one of those where it goes against clear reason that this cannot be what it says it is. The Yad Hashem. We know from Hashkafic understandings, God does not have any physicality. That's not controversial. So when it says Yad Hashem, Eini Hashem, Oznei Hashem, it cannot be literal. How far do you take that? And we looked last week at the Rambam. The Rambam seems to say anything that goes clearly, at least the Rambam according to Rabbi Sacks, anything that goes clearly against science, you have to be looking for ways to interpret in a non-literal way. We saw Rav Meiselman disagreed with that very fundamentally. And we saw at the very end, which we were a bit fast, we had to rush it a bit, but I'd refer you to the sheet. Joshua Golding has an article many years ago in the Torah Armada Journal where he tries to sort of feel out the line. On the one hand, if you take every pasuk literally, you're an apikoros. On the other hand, if you take every pasuk non-literally, you're an apikoros. So you can't be safe by being extreme. You can usually never be safe by being extreme. The answer is somewhere in the middle. And he tries to feel out what are the fundamental assumptions of orthodoxy that if you go beyond a certain line, you're undermining. Rav Saadia was worried, he says explicitly, that if you start taking too much non-literally, then you'll undermine the entire system of Torah and mitzvahs. That's obvious. And the Torah is meant to be a system of Torah and mitzvahs, so it can't implode in itself. More on that another time. Very interesting. Lots written on it. I brought you the introduction of Rav Yoni Grossman for his book in Bereishis, of Rav Grommet for his book on Bereishis as well. But today we move into other areas. I want to show you today 6 other approaches and the pros and the cons as to how contemporary thinkers, let's put it that way, have looked at the contradiction between the age of the universe, as understood by science, around 13.8 billion years, and the age of the world, let's say, as 5,783. How do we put those two things together? So the first one, which is very famous, was championed by the Lubavitcher Rebbe, who was very vociferous on this, is maybe the world is only 5,783 years old. It just looks older because God made it look older. And there are classic sources for that. Have a look in numbers 1 and 2. Number 1 is the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah, Da'ama Rebbe Yeshua ben Levi. Kol Ma'aseh Breishis, B'Kamos HaNivru, all of the creation was made standing. God didn't create seeds and embryos that would later turn into animals. God created animals, Rashi says. V'hainu eitz pri, it says there was an eitz pri, ra'ui haya litz'on pri miyad. It had fruit on the tree. So where did the fruit come from? It didn't have to grow.
You're going to create a tree, you might as well create it when it's ready to be used.
Right. Now, again, if you're looking at the last week's share, you'll be asking, well, why are you understanding eitz pri as literally? Let's put all that behind us. Eitz pri means there's a tree with fruit on the tree. Presumably, that is, the tree had tree rings within it of a history that it never had. Number two. God created the mankind. The word Adam in Bereishis sometimes means the man-woman unit, sometimes means the male, and sometimes means humankind. You have to switch around the word Adam. So God created humankind as Afar. What does Afar mean? Literally dust or dirt. Rabbi Yehuda ben Sibar Simon Omer Ofer. Ofer is a young person, a youth. Olam al miliasoi nivra, the world was created, all ready to go. Amar Rabbi Elazar ben Shimon, af chava too, Adam and chava, al miliasoi nivres, when Adam, whatever it means that God separated chava from Adam, he didn't present Adam with a newborn baby girl and said, mazel tov, this is your wife in a few years from now. He presented her with Adam, with chava. Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Adam v'chava kibnei esrim shana nivru. Yisrim Shana, that's what an offer is. A young person, a young man, a young woman, they were made aged around 20 years old. Which is actually very interesting because when he gives you the age of Adam, that he lived till he was 930, does this assume that, well, it's actually 910, isn't it, because he started at 20? Or do we count the 930 from the... whatever. In the 19th century, there was a non-Jewish debate that was known as the Omphalos hypothesis. This asked a question that from a Jewish perspective seems like a rather trite and silly question. The word omphalos is a fancy word for your navel or your belly button. And there was a fellow called Goss, Philip Henry Goss, who suggested the following. Did Adam Harishon have a belly button? It's basically the same question as did the trees have tree rings? Which is, did he have evidence of a history that never was? Why did he need a belly button? He never had an umbilical cord. Etc. Again, maybe from a Jewish perspective, the question sounds almost ridiculous. If Adam Harishon walked in the room, he would be so spiritual, I'm not even sure you'd be able to see him at all, never mind talk about the omphalos. But this was a question that went through the 19th century. It was put in the Jewish terms, you see these classic sources, Rabbi Avigdor Miller, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, made this case, and Rabbi David Gottlieb. Here's some more sheets. If anybody wants some more sheets, please put your hand up. There we are, over here, there's a few. Papa Bakasha, Mamash Toda. Gentlemen over here. Okay, I mean, whatever else we need, we'll share. There's one over here as well. Yesh Echad Po, Im Yesh Od Echad. Toda. Okay. Okay, it's like giving out candies on Simchas Torah. Everybody, they'll soon be scrambling on the floor to get them. Okay. Rabbi Gottlieb, who, as many of you probably know him personally, I know him personally, he's very respected, Rav in Or Sameach, he's a deep, 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 deep thinker. Rabbi Gottlieb was a PhD and a professor where was he again? Johns Hopkins. He's a PhD in mathematical logic. Rabbi Gottlieb writes, and it's there, I brought you a source where you can find his essay on the internet, number 3, over on page 2. The solution to the contradiction between the age of the earth and the universe according to science and the Jewish date of 5755, you see this was around 30 years ago, since creation, is this. The real age of the universe is 5755 years. He's quite happy with that. as a PhD scientist. But it has misleading evidence of greater age. The bones, artifacts, partially decayed radium, potassium, argon, uranium, the red shifted light from space, etc. All of it points to a greater age, which nevertheless is not true. God put these things in the universe, and they lead many to false conclusions of a much greater age. Now, he said that the evidence is misleading. Does that mean God is tricking us? Not at all. Only someone who perversely decides to ignore the statements of the Creator and rely only on what he can investigate will be led to a false conclusion. Only to such a person is the evidence misleading. And note that this policy of creating the world looking different from its true nature is an inescapable Jewish idea. Why? For we recite twice every morning that God constantly recreates the universe, even though this is not observable. Interesting. He wants to say there's a lot more going on here than meets the eye. God is recreating the universe. Now, I could argue that, of course, God is beyond time. By definition, time we'll see later on in the shir, is one of the creations. The Ramban says that. God is beyond time, and therefore, from the perspective of God, the creation is happening right now. The original creation is happening right now. There is no 5,000 years ago or 13 billion years ago. It's all right now in one eternal, infinite present. And therefore, the Vayihi or of creation is, for God, just one present. But anyway, Rabbi Gottlieb seems very happy with the idea that the universe looks older than it really is. Now, obviously, God couldn't create Adam and Chava as an embryo. That makes sense in the Pshat. But why would God try to fool us with fossils? So Rabbi Gottlieb said, he's not trying to fool us. Just read the Torah. You can see the truth in the Torah. You want to be misled by science, you can be misled by science. Is it a test, a faith? If so, well, there are other ways to answer the question of the fossils. Where do the fossils come from? We'll see other answers here. So if it's a test, maybe there are other answers. There's also Rav Aryeh Kaplan brings a principle where he says here, number four, everything was created apart from Sheker. Hakol bara kodesh baruch hu ba'olamo. This is a Tanur of Eliyahu. Everything was created in this world. Chutz mimidat hasheker. Apart from the concepts of falsehood, that's not in creation. Shaloi bara. God didn't create Sheker. Man created Sheker. So Rav Gottlieb would answer, it's not Sheker. Just look in the Torah. You'll get the emes. The world, the Alma de Shikra. Yeah, the physical world is misleading. We call this an Alma de Shikra. But the Torah will not mislead you. Now, how far does this go? The cave paintings, which look like they're 10,000 years old, were they created with creation? So, Rav Gottlieb will say, yeah, they were. The red shifted light, we said. What about civilizations that we think lived around 6,000 years ago? Were they created later with false memories of things that they thought happened in their past that didn't happen in their past? Okay, maybe. One of the questions which was raised by Bertrand Russell on this question is what's called the 5-minute hypothesis, which is, if God created the world 6,000 years ago, looking billions of years old, maybe God created the world 5 minutes ago. But we were all just planted in here with memories. We all think we came to a shir today, but we were really all created at 10:25 with memories as if we'd just been like here all the time.
Sounds like a major.
I mean, it's impossible to refute. Now, you might turn around and say, well, no, because come on, five minutes is extreme skepticism. There's no basis for that. It's arbitrary. Whereas 6,000 years is based on Psukim. That's at least something. But it's a good question. Rav Kaplan writes here in number five. I quoted in the last time I talked about this in the shir from his book. What is it? Immortality, Resurrection, and the Age of the Universe. Now, I then found that this book by Rav Aryeh Kaplan was based on an earlier speech, a lecture that he gave to the Midwinter Conference of the Association of Orthodox Jewish Scientists on February the 18th, 1979. So I quoted in this year more from his original speech. Look what he said, number five. The difficulty is that one could use a similar argument to say that Hashem created the universe 5 minutes ago. Again, that's Bertrand Russell's original argument. There is no question that an omniscient God certainly could have created us all with our memories, with all the records, with all of our histories. It's very possible to say that the world was created 5 minutes ago. I wrote 5 minuets ago by mistake. This is not a dance class, so excuse me for the typo. But this weakens the above argument. It is possible that Hashem created the world 6,000 years ago, then everything is possible. Of course, it is an irrefutable argument. I can't logically refute it. Therefore, if one feels comfortable with it, I would say all well and good. But I think that it has problems. It touches on almost intellectual dishonesty. And Sufism, it presents us with more problems than it answers. It seems to make all of Judaism depend on a glib argument. And this is, you know, in my humble opinion, I also feel this. It seems very unsatisfying as an argument. Maybe illogical. Rav Gottlieb is an unbelievable, logical genius. It's logical. But is it satisfying as an argument? He thinks no. But there's an even deeper problem. In no place in Torah literature do we find that Hashem created the universe so that it should appear to be billions of years old. If not for current scientific discoveries, no one would have ever made such a statement based on Torah sources alone. Therefore, this approach is nothing more than apologetics. So it's these people trying to excuse their way out of it. And later in his book, Immortality, Resurrection, the Age of the Universe, he says, actually, this approach was first postulated by a Gentile scientist a few years before Darwin published his theory of evolution. At the time, scientists looked upon it as being a silly argument. Even before Darwin, it doesn't seem any more convincing today. And there's another issue that must be dealt with squarely, and I think this is perhaps the most important problem. Many fundamentalist Christian groups have adopted the idea of creationism, a teaching based on the literal interpretation of the Bible. Of course, since Gentiles do not take the oral law into consideration, their approach is certain to be very different to ours. Moreover, many of their arguments have been very effectively refuted by some of the best scientific minds. That Orthodox Jews should align themselves with such groups is both dangerous and anti-Torah. And that, I think, is key when you're talking about this kind of argument. Because creationism in America is a big force. And it's seen in the whole binary political debate where it's, you know, good versus evil, depending on which side of the political spectrum you are. Creationism is aligned with, the anti-scientific thinking, anti-logical, conspiracy theory, far right, whatever you want to call it. Well, I didn't want to mention any names, but creationism is not what we believe in. And if we start telling people that we think the world is 6,000 years old, literally, then we will be aligned with those people with whom we have very little in common, either religiously or hashkafically, you know, in so many different ways. So I think that's an important point. There's a danger. Of course, Rabbi Gottlieb wrote his thing 30 years ago. There was no Trump. There was no, none of this existed in the same way it does today. Maybe he would change his mind. Maybe he wouldn't. But that's a concern that I have. Personally, you know, Lufi Ani Adaiti, that argument doesn't satisfy me, but it was presented by Gedolei Yisrael. It definitely stands out there. Fine. That's one approach. Another approach. I put here approach three because one was last week already. So three and four, I'm going to deal with very quickly. Three was suggested by Rav Hirsch, the Malbim rather than a Tziv, in the 19th century. They wanted to say that the world looks old because of the cataclysm of the flood. You may have heard this, that really the flood squished and pressured everything into fossils, and it made it all look incredibly old because there was such intense pressure. There was that? It wrinkled the earth, okay? Some people say that the world's axis shifted at the flood, meaning the flood, if you look at the Gemaras, the Midrashim, the flood affected all of nature, of the constellations, the stars. They wanted to say that's what made everything look old. Okay, you know something, the problem with that approach is it worked in the 19th century, looking at 19th century science. It doesn't work today. So I don't need to find an approach to explain a problem that was a problem that's not even our problem. It was a problem 150, 200 years ago. And so I don't think you'll find many people quoting that. But it does show that people like the Malbim, the Netziv, were trying to find solutions. You remember in the mid-1900s, they were beginning to realize that the world is much older than the people thought. Then they were thinking millions because of the mountains, geology, etc. But it's an interesting methodology, but I don't think it helps us. Okay, approach number four, Rav Shimon Schwab writes this approach. That he's got an essay, How Old is the Universe, in Challenge. Challenge was one of those, you know, original books. You remember Challenge? With Rav Aryeh Carmel, Professor Cyril Dom. There was a whole generation of Orthodox scientists, eminent Orthodox thinkers, Talmidei Chachamim of the highest order, and eminent scientists as well, who started addressing these issues. Encounter was another book in that series, and Challenge, from the 1970s, 80s, maybe a bit later. And they quote Rav Shimon Schwab, who wants to say everything looks older because it all ran at a much higher speed at the beginning. If you imagine that the world was running at like millions of times its normal speed, so it only took 6 days to cover what would normally be billions of years. Okay, I'm not a big enough scientist to really refute that, but a lot of people say it doesn't make any sense. If the whole world was going at super speed, it would just destroy itself completely. How are you going to refer 6 days? What are 6 days? It seems to be very arbitrary. So I'm not going to dwell on that. You can read his essay in Challenge, but I don't think that's one of the major approaches. Now, number five is Rav Aryeh Kaplan says, look, if you're going to try and resolve this issue, you need to bring classic sources. Even if they're obscure, even if they're things that we hadn't read in that way before, you can't just invent stuff. You have to bring Makarot. So he says, this is what I found. Rav Aryeh Kaplan was one of the most fascinating Jews of the 20th century, without any question. He grew up in New York as a traditional but non-Orthodox Jew. I think the story was his father died when he was very young and they needed to teach him to say Kaddish when he was a teenager. And somebody took him under their wing in the Lower East Side, I believe, and took him in to teach him to say Kaddish. And they realized within a short time that they had a total genius on their hands there, and he became one of the greatest Jewish thinkers, Kabbalistic thinkers, and his books are phenomenal. And if you read his footnotes, forget about the books, if you read the Encyclopedia of Jewish Thought, two volumes with all the footnotes, it'll keep you going for at least another 100 years. No question. It's a phenomenal, phenomenal thing. And they're still giving out these books in NCSY. When I was in NCSY last year in Yachi Kala, they gave to all of the kids a set of reprinted Rabbi Kaplan books, which says a lot that someone speaking to youth in the 1960s and the 1970s can still speak to youth in 2022. That's a very remarkable gift, and it really does, and they really appreciate it. But he said as follows. He said, look at this source. Number seven. I'm Rabbi Yehuda Bar Simon. Yehi Erev Ein Ksiv Kan. It doesn't say Yehi Erev, Yehi Boker. It says Va Yehi Erev. Okay, so you'll see, turn around to me and say, of course, it's the Vava Hippo. It just turns the future tense into the past tense. Shkayach, yes, that's the Pshat. But he says, the Chazal say, Mikan, from this Vav, Shehaya Sedel Zmanim Kodem Lake. There was a whole Sedel Zmanim before we even start 5,783 years ago. God was creating worlds and destroying them, creating and destroying, creating and destroying, until he got to our world, where he said, this will do. You can imagine what the other ones look like, but this is a great world. He said, God said, Dein Hanyanli, this world will give nachas. Baruch Hashem, it's an amazing world. Yashan Lai Hanyanli, the other ones didn't please me. The other ones had to destroy. Amr Pinchas Tamid Tamid Rabbi Eva. What does he mean? Why is Rabbi Eva coming from? Vayara Lokim is Kol Asher Asa Vehine Tov Maod. This world really is the best world, and it's a hashgafic point when we look around the world and we sometimes feel a bit despondent. We have to say no. This world is Tov Maod. This is the best of all worlds that there could be. Dein Hanyanli. This one pleases me. Yaton Loi Hanyanli. The others don't please me. Yes.
In a way, you would think that if God is almighty and all-powerful, that he can immediately create the correct worlds. Why does he need worlds, build worlds that are incorrect, destroy them again and build another one?
I don't know. I don't have a good answer to that question. I don't want to invent a bad answer to that question. Why of God is always logically an incorrect question. Because, like, I don't need why. You need to understand why you have to. Moshe Rabbeinu said on Harseini, Hareini Nais Kvodecha, show me, let me see. He said, no, you can't see. Okay, but that's a cop-out answer, even though it's true. I would just mention, by the way, that modern science posits the idea of a multiverse. We talked about this a little bit last week. The multiverse, since this world is, I think I mentioned this last week, has the Goldilocks problem. What's the Goldilocks problem? They talk about this. Goldilocks. You know Goldilocks?
Yeah.
Have that in Holland as well? Yeah, Goldilocks. So Goldilocks, okay, this porridge is too hot, this porridge is too cold, and this porridge is just right. Okay? So how could it be that the universe, not the world we live in, forget about a leaf or a human being, the universe is calibrated in a way which is so exact that one tiny fluctuation in any of these relationships and constants, etc., would result in total breakdown. Either everything would just explode in energy, or it would just freeze into inaction. And my wife bought me a book many, many years ago, written by Sir Martin Rees. Sir Martin Rees was, may still be, the astronomer royal. which means he's the queen, now the king's official astronomer. I don't know why the king needs an astronomer. I mean, the truth is, maybe King Charles needs an astrologer, but whatever. But maybe he needs an astronomer as well. But he wrote a book called Just Six Numbers. And it was a book all about how these relationships between key scientific constants, gravitational force, nuclear force, etc., are so finely calibrated that it's impossible to imagine that that would have happened in a coincidental way. The chances are beyond zero. So he says, so that was the first six chapters. So the seventh chapter says, so how do I explain this? He said, of course, if I was religious, I'd say that there's a creator and he put this into place. But I'm not religious, so I can't say that. Okay, fair enough. So he says, maybe it's the multiverse, which is that maybe there are an infinite number of universes in existence out there, of which every single one went wrong, except ours. And we just happened to be lucky enough to be in the universe where everything worked perfectly. Which is actually very similar to this idea of this source, that there are other universes out there that completely collapsed, that didn't work right. It's a must question, it's a good one, why should that be? But again, we talked about last week about this multiverse idea is a faith idea. It's not scientifically provable, it's a belief. So once scientists start saying, I believe this and I can't prove it, okay, so then they're going beyond science, but that's another discussion. So anyway, there is an idea that the worlds were created and destroyed. Go over to page four. We also then have a very important concept that the Chazal say, for example, Rabbeinu Bachya brings this, that the Torah existed 2,000 years before the universe. How long is a year? What does it mean when they talk about years before our creation, worlds before our world? So here's a few sources. Number eight, Iyov, Pasuk, Hakimei Enosh Yamecha, are the days of man like your days? Are your years like ours? You, God, are on a completely different scale. Now, of course, what that means on the pshat level is God is infinite and we are finite, and therefore there can be no comparison. But the Gemara does say, based on the Psukim elsewhere, that there may be a correlation in numbers. Look at number nine. Amarav Katina, Shit al Fisheni, Shani, Havo Alma Vachad Chorov. There's an idea that the world will last for 6,000 years and then be destroyed for 1,000 years. What is this? This is a sabbatical cycle. The idea of six and then a seven. A lot of people are familiar with another parallel Gemara that it'll be 2,000 years of Tohu Vavohu, 2,000 years of Torah, then 2,000 years for Mashiach can come. So this is like the seventh, the last 1,000 years is like the Shabbos of the world.
Why is Shabbos destruction?
It's rest, it's not creation. Good. You're asking logical questions. This is an Agadata. You have to be reading it on a deeper level. But yes, why is Shabbos Charuv? Maybe in terms of, I don't know. Compared to creation, it's a time of non-action, of desolation. I don't know, maybe that's the wrong answer. But then along comes, quoted by Rav Kaplan, the Sefer HaTzmuna. The Sefer HaTzmuna is an important Kabbalistic work, which is quoted by the Rishonim. It's a mainstream work in the Kabbalah. It's quoted by the Bet Yosef in on the halachas of the Hebrew letters or how to write them. And the Sefer HaTzmuna says that actually there's a larger sabbatical cycle. Not only is there 7,000, but like the Yovel, there's 7,000 and there's 7 times 7,000. Which is just an extension of the sabbatical idea. There's a Yovel cycle, a sabbatical cycle. And he says, according to many views, we're now in the seventh of those cycles. Which means there were six cycles of 7,000 years, whatever that means, before us. There are 42,000, quote-unquote, years before our world came into being. And now you come to Rav Shmuel of Akko. You have Yitzchak ben Shmuel, of Akko. The problem with this approach is it kind of stitches together lots of Kabbalistic ideas, but I trust Rabbi Kaplan that he thinks they can be stitched together. And this is the key. How long is a year in one of these grand sabbatical cycles? And for this we turn to Tehillim, number 10. Ki elef shanim be'einecha k'yom etmol ki avor. It's one day in your God reference is like 1,000 years. A God day is like 1,000 years. Now, if you set up that ratio, that one day in divine terms is like 1,000 of our years, so you have to multiply everything by 365,250. Why? Because 1,000 years times 365 and a quarter days in a year. So each God year corresponds to 365,250 human years. Just do the math based on the Pasuk in Tehillim. Again, that's another pshat in the Pesukim. Okay, that's a good question. Why solar years? Usually the word Shana means a solar year. That's what the word Rosh Hashanah is. That's not true, actually. Rosh Hashanah is the beginning of... Well, it's the beginning of... There's a change to the month that puts them in, you know, equilibrium again. But the word Shana normally means a year, means 365. 12 months, usually, of course, is a lunar year, which is 354. But 12 months is not normally called a year, I think. So here, so he says, lo and behold, if you take this number, that there are 365,250 years in one of God's years, and there are 42,000 in this cycle, then you magically get to around 15 billion. Okay? What's that? Because we're in the seventh cycle. There have been six cycles before us, six cycles of 7,000 years. Six times seven is 42. And then you end up with this. Another similar approach. There are 974 generations, Chazal say, before Adam. Okay? How long is a generation? Bonagid, 40 years. That's logical based on the Chumash as well. So 947 generations times 47 years, and then you do this, each year is really 365,000, da-da-da, because it's God years. Again, you get to 14 billion years. Now, you may turn around and say, this is a bit far-fetched.
Where did they come up with the 974?
That's a Chazal, that there were 974 generations before Adam. We talked a bit about this last year. That's last week. That's a Chazal. The Torah was given to the 1,000th generation, says the Pesukim. So Chazal say, you see, there were 26 from Adam to Moshe. There must have been 974 before. Last week we talked about the fact that this might mean there were hominids living on earth before man, that Adam was not alone. There were other non-Adams around when Adam was around. Yes, you're not happy with this. It's because you're an economist. This is
I'm not speaking as an economist.
Okay, fine.
I'm looking at this, and I think stretching it. I mean, it's like you know the answer you want to get.
Right.
So you figure out a way that you
right.
get there.
Right, right. Okay, so we'll get to that objection in a minute. I'm sure, says Rav Kaplan, number 11, that many will find this highly controversial. However, it's important to know that this opinion exists in our classical literature. Moreover, that one of the most important Kabbalists of 7 centuries ago calculated the age of the universe and came to the same conclusion as modern science. Okay, there is a fascinating essay in the Tiferes Yisrael called the Drush Or HaChaim. The Tiferes Yisrael is a commentary on the Mishnah, which was written in the mid-1800s. And in this commentary, he says some very interesting, he's a very unusual thinker, the Tiferes Yisrael. He says some highly unusual things. We quoted once. He says, if I asked you what was my top list of 6 non-Jewish people that contributed most to the world, who would they be? And he gives his whole list there. We talked about that, the creation of the discovery of vaccines. He puts him on the list as well. But one of the things he gives is he talks about fossils and how they made, because fossils were already coming out of the ground, and they didn't call them monsters anymore. In the ancient world, they called them monsters. But by the 19th century, it's like, yeah, leave me alone with monsters. These got here somehow. These were animals that lived at one point, mammoths and dinosaurs. And he writes this Drush Or HaChaim, and it became very controversial to the point that in the early editions of the Tiferes Yisrael, you'll find them in many shuls where this has been ripped out. Rav Kaplan says he once went to pick one up to show somebody, and all the pages have been ripped out. In the modern editions of Tiferes Yisrael, it's often not included at all. And there are some people, especially Hasidim, that refuse to study Tiferes Yisrael full stop because of this Drush Or HaChaim. Interesting. Some people accused the Tiferes Yisrael, Rav Israel Lipschitz, of being apologetic to explain Darwin. The problem is that he wrote the Peiros 20 years before Darwin wrote The Origin of Species. Okay, but that's aside. So the Drush Or HaChaim also talks about these kind of ideas. But there are problems, as you said, with this approach, stitching together all these Kabbalistic things. First of all, not everyone agrees that we're in the seventh sabbatical cycle. According to some Kabbalists, we're in the second sabbatical cycle. Now, I don't know what any of this means. Please go speak to your local Orthodox Kabbalist. And they will. It is important to find an Orthodox Kabbalist, by the way. And they'll maybe explain it to you. So I don't know exactly how this works. Maybe it's stitching together this and that to try and make something work, almost as if you're trying to get to the conclusion that you're trying to reach. Although I trust Rabbi Kaplan's integrity and authenticity, and if he thinks this is valid, then at least it's an approach. The Nitziv points out that, one second, these worlds were destroyed. So why are we finding the bones under the ground? It's one thing to talk about a universe that was there and is no longer there, but it shouldn't be just like 20 feet under the ground. It should be gone, etc. And Rav David Zvi Hoffman also said, this is not helpful because this all explains what happens before creation. I'm trying to explain how 5,783 years from creation fits, not what happened before creation. So he says, this doesn't really help us. And Rav Moshe Sternbuch is very unhappy. Rav Moshe Sternbuch, as you know, he was the Greibed of the Eda Charedis in Yerushalayim. And he writes in number 12. And this is clearly, I think, aimed at the kind of thing that we just read from Rabbi Kaplan. However, what we can't understand, we rely on our faith. It is obvious that man's thoughts are not comparable to God's in the ability to understand nature. Similarly, we acknowledge that we can't comprehend or adequately explain God's ways concerning good and evil in each generation. Okay, fine, that's a good Hashkafa point. In these issues, we simply rely on our faith in God's greatness. In contrast, they prefer to explain that man is the product of millions of years of development. As evidence, they cite what appears to be ancient bone fragments that have been discovered in Madagascar and other places. This is of ancient humans, Homo sapiens, Homo erectus, etc., before Homo sapiens. Their evidence is total nonsense. Since prior to the flood, man lived for 1,000 years. This difference is what normal growth and development makes the bones to appear as if they were millions of years old. With this type of shaky evidence, they want to refute the words of our sages and undermine the faith that exists amongst the Jewish people. Over the page. Their main concern, this is the scientists, is to shake the faith in God, which has been accepted by us generation after generation. They want to replace this faith with the acceptance of events that are determined primarily by the laws of nature. Scientists, even those who are described as religious, are ashamed that we don't agree with the views of leading scientists that man is descended from the apes. They rush to find isolated statements of our sages, rabbis and commentaries that seem consistent with contemporary scientific view. Therefore, they use misleading and distorted citations from Torah literature to claim justification for such scientific beliefs in the words of the sages. He's not happy. There's music coming from somewhere. It may be in somebody's bag, I'm not sure. Whatever. Either way, it'll turn itself off, and then it'll probably ring again 10 seconds later. Rav Moshe Sternbuch's not happy. He says this is forced Torah to try and fit Torah with science. Okay, he feels that science has an anti-religious agenda. In some cases it does, in some cases it doesn't. You know, Richard Dawkins, clearly and openly has a very virulent anti-religious agenda. But Rav Moshe Sternbuch says, we're not interested in any of this. We're quite happy if the world is 5,783 years old. We don't have to distort Torah in order to fit with science because science is not MS. Rabbi Kaplan doesn't like this. He wasn't himself, he was a scientist actually. He was a physicist. And Rabbi Kaplan has an interesting source in number 13, which I don't think made it into his book. But this was in his speech. Another approach is that which many Hasidim have. Now, Rav Moshe Sternbuch is not technically a Hasid, but it's the same kind of approach. They say, what do scientists know? Do they know what's happening? Do they know what's going on? They're a bunch of phonies, a bunch of bluffers, a bunch of stupid nicks. Maybe stupid nicks was a word in the 1960s that everybody in the 70s was into. I've never used it before, but there we are. Do they really have a way of finding out the truth? But I think to somebody who knows what science is, this is a very unsatisfactory approach. We have some idea of what is involved in paleontology. We have some idea of what is involved in geology and radioactive dating. We have some idea of what is involved in astronomy. So I would say that if someone feels that science is ignorant and false, all well and good. Like he said, where the universe is old, yeah? Many people prefer not to accept science as a worthy challenge. But I think that for many of us here, such an approach will be totally unsatisfying. Okay, you can, pick your, sides and decide how you feel about this. Now, There are two major remaining arguments, both of which, one of which has classic source background, and the other of which is a modern idea by Dr. Gerald Schroeder that we'll talk about at the end. The sixth approach, which is the one which I think most people know, is, well, who said the 6 days were really days? Meaning, I'm not talking about rereading the story of Bereshit as a non-literal account of the spiritual foundations of the universe. I'm just saying that the word yom doesn't mean day, doesn't always mean day. And there's a lot of good support for that. Have a look in number 14. This is the problem that we're going to have to address. The Ramban. The Ramban says in number 14 on Bereshit, last week's Parsha, Veda. And you should know. Ki hayamim haniskarim b'ma'aseh Bereshit. The days that are described in Ma'aseh Bereshit. Hayu b'briyas ha-shamayim v'aretz yamim mamash. They were real days. M'chubarim misha'ot v'regaim. They were made of hours and minutes. V'hayu shisha k'sheshet yimei hama'aseh. And these were 6 days, just like the 6 days of the working week. Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. That was the days of creation. So don't go and tell me that the days were not days. That's the pshat. K'pshuto shel mikra. U'b'pnimiyas ha'enyin, but on a much deeper level, yikru'u yamim, what are these things called days? Ha'sefirot. They're really the sefirot on a spiritual level. Ha'atsulot me'elyon, which are emanated from on high. The idea of the Sefirot, the Ramban, was wrote before the publication of the Zohar, but nevertheless had a Sefirotic approach to Kabbalah, that there were 10 Sefirot, of which the 7 are available to us and 3 are hidden. I'm not getting into the whole Kabbalistic idea of the Sefirot. Now it's very mainstream Kabbalah, certainly after the Zohar, the Arizal. These days really are the Sefirot. The Ha'perush b'sidur ha'ksuvim b'zeh, and really what's going on in these psukim, the explanation is nizgav v'ne'elam, is so refined, hidden, so removed from our understanding. V'da'ateinu bo pachot mitzipa min hayam ha'gadol. Whatever you think you understand of what's going on in Bereshit, it's a drop in the ocean, literally. Well, not literally, but it's a drop in the ocean. So what do I do with this Ramban? He said the days were 24 hours mamash, but if you think you know what's really going on here, you're wrong. Okay, so were they 24 hours on a pshat level? Does pshat mean that that's what happened? It's an interesting question. What is pshat? Is pshat what you would play back if you were standing with a video recorder, recording something from an episode in Tanakh? Is that what's happening in pshat, or is pshat already a level removed from the physical, historical, actual thing that was going on? I mentioned it last week. You know, if you'd have been recording, I go like this, but nobody does this anymore, obviously, for a long time. But if you'd have been, like, recording on a phone, Paro speaking to Yosef, I assume he would have spoken in Egyptian and not said the words that are actually written in the Psukim, because they're written in Hebrew, obviously, because they're given to Bnei Israel in the desert. Which is interesting, because the Torah could have put them in Egyptian after these people spoke Egyptian, which is interesting. But he didn't put them in Hebrew. And therefore, is pshat that this is what Paro said. Is this what Paro actually said? No. So what is pshat? So that's an interesting question. But the Ramban says it's a challenge. However, the evidence for yom being a flexible word is very significant. Number 15. Vayikra Elokim la'or yom. God called the light day. Ulechoshek haralayla vayhi erev vayhi voker yom echad. There you see the word yom is used in two completely different ways. God called the light day. How long is that? 12 hours. Then vayhi erev vayhi voker yom echad. That's 24 hours. So yom is obviously a flexible word. Just like we said, the word Adam sometimes means the male, sometimes means the unit, sometimes means mankind. In number 16. Eile told us Hashemayim va'aretz. These are the generations of the heavens and the earth. Behibbaram, when they were created. Beyom asot Hashem lokim eretz v'shamayim. On the day that God made the universe, eretz v'shamayim. Is that yom all 7 days? Maybe yom is even longer than a day. Look at number 17. Kol mitzvah dvarim. Kol mitzvah she'anochi mitzvah hayom. All the mitzvah I'm commanding you today, tishmeru la'asot, etc. What's that? Is that just the mitzvah God saying that day? No, he means today means during the 40 years in the Midbar. All the mitzvahs that I'm commanding you. So you see, yom is actually an interesting word, which on a pshat level is flexible. It can mean 12 hours, it can mean 24 hours, It can mean the 7 days of creation. It can mean maybe the 40 years. Remember the word Yamim. Lavan says to Eliezer or to Eved Abraham, let her stay with us for 10 months or Yamim. Yamim there means a year. Really? Yamim means a year. The word Yom is on a Pshat level a flexible word. So what does Yom mean in the context of Bereishis? Also we have a fascinating Rashi, number 18. Lahavdil ben hayom uben halayla. That the light and the dark were separated. There was a distinction between them. Look at what Rashi says. This is an amazing Rashi. Mishenignas ha'or harishon. But this Yom v'layla thing only started when the original holy spiritual light was hidden away. When did Yom v'layla start? When the original light. What is the light of the first day? It's not the light of the sun. We know this. Rashi talks about this because the sun was on day four. Says Rashi, aval b'shivat yemei breshit, on all 7 days of creation, shimshu ha'or v'hachoshech harishonim. The original spiritual light and spiritual darkness acted together. Yachad. Bein b'yom u'bein b'layla. Are you getting clearer or are you getting less clear? Meaning the light of the 7 days of creation is not day night. It's not the earth and the sun in earth spinning on its axis and the sun, it's a different light, it's a different day, it's a different thing. What's going on there? Elsewhere he says in number 19 that it sounds like it is Esrim V'Arba Sha'ot. That there's an idea that on the first day, Midat Yomu Midat Laila was created. So it's an unclear pattern. But Rav David Zvi Hoffman, who was a major Jewish thinker in the late 19th century, he says, number 20, explicitly in his commentary on the Torah, on Genesis, in many places, and especially in the Zohar, it is proven that the expression day as it appears in the account of creation is not to be understood as an ordinary human day of 24 hours, but rather the intent is the day of God, which lasts 1,000 years, but he's not doing any fancy, calculations here. That is to say that a day lasts for an undefined length of time. That's interesting. 1,000 years doesn't mean 1,000 years. 1,000 times 360. It means a long, undefined time. And therefore he says the 6 days of creation could happily have been millions, billions of years. In his day they were talking millions. In our day they're talking billions. But there's no difference between them. There are questions on that approach. Rav Shimon Schwab says, well, 1 second. If the 6 days of creation and Shabbos were not real days, why do we keep Shabbos for 24 hours? We should keep Shabbos for an undefined length of time. To which you can answer, well, how do we know which day is Shabbos? Was anyone counting from Adam originally? We don't know Shabbos from the creation story. Where do we know Shabbos from? How do we know that we've got the right day for Shabbos? Maybe we got mixed up. When did we start counting? And the answer is, when the man fell. That's when we start counting Shabbos. The man fell from Shamayim. And on Friday, double fell. On Shabbos, none fell. Nobody was counting from the Shishisha Shimei Bereishis. So we know Shabbos is Shabbos from the Midbar. We don't know Shabbos is Shabbos from the man. So maybe that answers his question. And there are other kashes that I brought there as well that we don't find any evidence of in Rishonim clearly of this idea. This is intuited from these sources. And what does evening and morning mean? Vayhi erev, vayhi boker. You're telling me that a day means millions, billions of years. So what's vayhi erev? So you turn around and say, okay, well, it doesn't mean evening and morning. Just like Yom means something more than you think, Erev means something, Boker means something, Chava means something, the Satan means, the snake means something, the tree means, it all means something more than you think it means, and therefore don't start taking it in such a literal way. There are some that want to say that, well, look, the order of the Torah even matches the order that scientists feel that things evolved. Well, sort of. Not really. Meaning, light works well. In the beginning, there was light. Okay, light, energy, plasma, Big Bang, whatever. That's fine. But then it starts to get a little bit difficult. For example, the moon and the sun, in scientific terms, came way, way before the dry land and the plants, etc. How can the earth have plants, etc. on it, and then the moon and the sun appear only after that? So you could turn around and say, which some do suggest, It says on the fourth day the sun and the moon were put in their place because only then could they be seen from the earth. Why? Because the early earth was extremely humid. It was completely covered in cloud cover, just like Venus is covered in cloud cover, not water clouds, but other chemical clouds. And therefore, only at a certain point did the clouds clear, the earth cool enough so that you could see them under the sun and the moon. Okay, that's very interesting. That might be the case. But I'll leave you to read this through. The order doesn't really work very well. Rabbi Slifkin talks about this. It's a little bit far-fetched to push that in, but, you know, maybe I certainly find personally, and for what it's worth, that the idea of the day being longer than 24 hours is a perfectly satisfying approach. I think that's one that a lot of people take. And that's one that, as I said, Rav Dovid Tzvi Hoffman is perfectly happy about. The last approach, which I think is in some ways scientifically the most interesting, which makes it the most the least reliable for someone who doesn't understand science, which is me, is the following. Gerald Schroeder, Dr. Gerald Schroeder, who, as you know, is an eminent scientist. I think he's in Bar-Ilan. Is he in Bar-Ilan? He was in Bar-Ilan. He was talking on the circuit. Maybe you know, 20 years ago he was around. Itamar reminded me he came to London, Israel, in the 90s. It must have been in the 90s. And he's still lecturing. He's still writing books. He wrote a number of books on this. Gerald Schroeder said, look, the theory of relativity will actually come to our aid because time is not constant. And we know this. Since Einstein, we know that we can prove this scientifically. Time is relative. It depends on the speed that one's going. Time goes very slightly slower the faster you go. It depends on the mass. It depends on the gravity. We know this. You can read any number of books on how this works. That time will pass differently for different people, depending on all of these other factors. So time itself is part of the created universe. It's not an absolute thing. So says Gerald Schroeder the following. From the perspective of the Torah, as creation is happening, time looks like a day. But from our perspective, looking back, after the universe has expanded, and as the universe has expanded, time has expanded, if you like, to us that looks like millions and billions of years. Take an analogy. I don't know if he brings this analogy, maybe he does, but I heard this. I think it works for me anyway. Let's take a balloon that's deflated before you blow it up, and take a pen and draw like 1 millimeter line on it. And now blow up the balloon, and that millimeter line is now much, much, much longer. What happened? That from the perspective of the deflated balloon, it was just a millimeter. From the perspective of the inflated balloon, it now looks to be much bigger because the whole thing has stretched. So it turns around Dr. Schroeder and says that the world really was created in 6 days because from the perspective of creation, each of those was a one-day input at that point in the expansion of the universe, which now looking back, those days are much bigger. And as you go through the days, it gets to a smaller and smaller amount as we approach the universe we have. So day one, which was 24 hours from creation perspective, is 7 billion years. But day two is 3.5 billion years. Day three is 1.8 billion years. Day four is 9.9 billion years. Day five is 0.45 billion years, etc., etc. Okay, this is fascinating. Very interesting. Does he have any sources? Maybe. Have a look in a couple of important Rambans. That's why I think this is an important source in Limud HaTorah. The Ramban says in number 21, Ki mishiyatsu hashamayim v'haaretz, when creation was made, min ha'efes, from zero, from nothing, el hayesh, to something, creation ex nihilo, yeah, niska b'posuk harishon, as we see in the first posuk, nihiye zman. This is a very interesting idea for a 13th century Jewish thinker to be talking about what is time. I mean, again, you can read many books on this. It's not clear what time is. Is time just something that we invent in our minds to make sense of what's happening around us, but it doesn't actually exist? Or is time a real thing, an absolute thing? How does time work? So he says time was created, very clearly. Ki afal pi shezmanenu beregaim v'sha'ot shehem ba'or b'choshech. Okay, because even though our time today is measured in minutes and hours, etc., day and light, misheyihye yesh, from the time that there was existence, yitpas bo zman. Could zman have any real hold, purchase on what's relevance? Time only is part of the. In the ancient world, they thought that time was a product of motion. that when something moves, it takes a certain amount of time. We don't feel that today, but the Ramban is getting into that rather deep philosophical issue of what is Zman. Look in number 22. He later says in the next Ramban, Vayikra Elokim la'or yom, yomar, because you have to say, ki nivra hazman, va'asa midat yom u'midat laila. That's when the whole concept of yom and laila were created. That's when Zman was created. And then Schroeder brings what I think is a really convincing source. What does it say at the end of the first day, number 23? Vayhi erev, vayhi voker, yom echad. What should it have said? Yom Rishon. Now, well known is Rashi, who says yom echad, because that was the day when the only the one of everything that echad, Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem echad, that was the day when God alone started on that day, there was nothing else but him. But the Ramban has a different, fascinating perspective. What the Ramban says, yom echad. Va'al derech ha-pshat, lo yitachen loma yom rishon. Because the pshat wasn't able to say yom rishon. Why not? Ba'avur she'adayin lo na'aseh ha-sheni. Because there was no second. And you can't have a first until there's a second. Ki ha-rishon kodem sheni. The first has to come before the second. B'minyan or b'male, aval shneihem nimsan, but they have to both exist. Va'ha'echad lo yore el sheni. But the word echad means there was no second yet. Now, what's the Ramban saying, says Dr. Schroeder? That the Torah is not describing creation from the perspective of the Jewish people at Matan Torah. Because then looking back, it would have been Yom Rishon, Yom Sheni. Because from the later perspective, there was a first, a second, a third. The Torah is describing creation from the perspective of the Creator as he was creating. That's why there was only an Echad. And once you say that, says Schroeder, you see that the whole concept of time in the Torah is coming from the perspective of the Creator back then, not the perspective that we have now. I actually like that source, but the reason I like it may be because I don't really understand the science, as we'll get to in a minute. Look at number 24. Let's first of all see Schroeder. The first stable matter that formed from the energy of the Big Bang creation that, quotes, ages, unquotes, that experiences the passage of time was protons. The subatomic particles that produce much of the mass of an atom and are theorized to be the product of the decay of neutrons into electrons and protons. This was written recently, by the way, 2019. The Bible views time looking forward into the expanding space of the universe from the moment of the formation of protons, a moment that was a tiny fraction of a second following the Big Bang creation of the universe, when the universe was vastly smaller than it is today. Our Earth-based scientific measure views time looking back in time from the present perspective of our huge universe towards that moment when protons formed. A tiny fraction of a second following the Big Bang creation of the universe, a time when the universe was vastly smaller than it is today. And again, like I said, that's how a day then is actually, looking back, billions of years now. 25, if we can calculate the magnitude of the expansion of the universe from the start of the biblical calendar 6 days to now, we can calculate how the 14 billion years, brackets, dinosaurs and all the rest, close brackets, would appear from the perspective of the Bible. The key word here is perspective. We are calculating the age of the universe from two vastly different perspectives. The Bible's perspective looking forward from the beginning, when the universe was vastly smaller than now, and our perspective looking back, with the universe being vastly larger than the era near the creation, they are two views of one reality. Now, I remember in Kola, Rav Berkowitz, who is the Rosh Shiva of Eish HaTorah, they asked the Shaila, I've forgotten who they asked back then, are they allowed to teach this approach of Gerald Schroeder? Because, you know, young, intelligent, educated people in the Kirov, structure really like this. So are they allowed to teach it given that it doesn't have clear sources? Okay, the Ramban is an interesting source, but it's not explicit. And they were told, yes, because it doesn't go against anything the Torah said, but you have to, you know, teach it as, you know, this is a scientific suggestion by a frum scientist as to how it might work. Okay, very nice. Everyone's happy, except not everyone's happy, because Professor Natan Aviezer is not happy at all. Natan Aviezer, like Gerald Schroeder, is an eminent frum scientist. Again, I think associated with Bar-Ilan. They're probably around the same age. They wrote sparring books. I put on the very first page. You can see them. You know, Natan Aviezer wrote Modern Science and Ancient Faith, and then Gerald Schroeder wrote Genesis and the Big Bang, and they kind of go back and forth on each other. And look at what Aviezer says, number 26. Go back to number 26 and page 7. Recently, there's been an attempt to reconcile the biblical timescale with modern science by invoking Einstein's theory of relativity. This explanation fails. because relativistic time dilation is an extremely small effect, which cannot possibly compress 10 billion years into a mere 6 days. Indeed, this proposal was characterized by Professor Barry Simon, a distinguished physicist at the California Institute of Technology, as, quotes, a fundamental misunderstanding of basic physics immediately recognized as fallacious by professional physicists. Okay, if that's not a shtetl to General Schroeder, what is? But at this point, I step back and allow the eminent and respected scientists to argue it out, because I don't have anything to say other than this is very interesting. So hopefully that summarizes both last week and this week some of the approaches. Yes, sir? Right. That's true. The problem is, we are actually trying to work out what's going on the open side of the bet. That's the problem, because we're trying to work out what's going on in Brachius. But the point is well put, that there's a lot here that we're never going to understand. Okay, so that's Adkan here. Next week, I'm not sure who's going to be here, but I can assure you they'll be excellent. And I will see you, Be'ezrat, what's that? Rav Herzog, excellent. And in about 4 weeks, I will be back, Be'ezrat Hashem, for something completely different. Okay, thank you very much. Have a great day.